Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show, brought to you by Old Mutual Investment Group. Invest where the fund managers invest. So we've got some good news, and that is that the ratings agency S&P has decided to leave their rating unchanged. Immediately after Pravin Gordhan and Lisi Jonas were fired, we saw Fitch downgrade South Africa. There are two levels of debt. There's local debt and there is foreign denominated debt. In other words, the local debt is 90% of the debt that we have as a country is in rands, about 10% is in dollars. So Fitch said, both rand and dollar, it's a disaster, go to sub-investment grade immediately, and that's what Fitch did. S&P immediately said, we're worried about the dollar debt, so 10% of your debt is sub-investment grade, 90% is still investment grade. Today, they've come out with another announcement saying, we're happy to leave it like that for now. So we're still investment grade on the important big chunk. So South Africa will still get foreign flows of income coming into our bond market. We can expect the currency to continue to perform well. And we can expect all of those positives that come out of that to remain in place for now. The rand has strengthened a little bit in the last few minutes. 12.80 to the dollar. To the pound, we're sitting at 16.46. The euro, 14.43. So a little bit more strength on the day. We were already on a strengthening trend as a result of the U.S. jobs market. The U.S. Economy employed another 137,000 people last month, which is a huge number by our standards, but paltry by their standards, and so they were very disappointed with that. We saw the dollar come under pressure. Also, I'm going to read you today's announcement word for word from Eskom, because it's important that we read word for word, and if you spot any inconsistency or any nuance or any clause that suggests that there could be return of Brian 3, then please let me know, because Brian Molefe confirmed today that he is out of Eskom again. But his reinstatement's been rescinded. But now the Eskom board has issued a statement. Statement by Dr. Ben Ngobani, the Eskom board chairperson. I'm reading you every word. Eskom board gives effect to minister's directive. Now, subtext to that is, we don't really want to do this, but we have to, otherwise we're going to get fired too. Then it says, Friday the 2nd of June 2017, that's today, the Eskom board has this morning given effect to the minister's directive to rescind its decision to reinstate Mr. Brian Molefe as group chief executive of Eskom. Rescind its decision to reinstate. So it admits that he'd resigned and then he came back. That's what reinstate means. That's my understanding of reinstate, because there have been lots of lies about this. In giving effect to and on the basis of the minister's directive contained in the letter dated 31st of May 2017, it was resolved that the resolution of the board of directors taken on the 2nd of May 2017 is rescinded. Furthermore, it was resolved that the reinstatement agreement concluded between Mr. Molefe and Eskom on the 11th of May 2017 be rescinded. In consequence, Mr. Molefe is no longer the group chief executive of Eskom and will no longer serve as a director of the board of Eskom. I'm looking, I'm turning the page over. Nowhere does it say for now. So this could be the final word on this particular matter.
The Money Show,
your number one news and talk station.
Well, the big story is that our local debt, the big chunk of our debt, remains investment grade. Dr. Mapopo Modise is Chief Director of Strategy and Risk Management at the National Treasury. Dr. Modise, this must be a relief, not only for me and for everybody listening, but for you in the National Treasury as well.
Good evening to you and your listeners. Certainly, this has been a relief for government, especially given that they decided not to change the local currency rating. That was one that we were more worried about. So it is indeed a relief. But I think it's not something that we should enjoy. Every country should aim at being investment grade, whether local currency or foreign currency debt. This gives us just a relief, but I think it's time for us as South African, even government, to work harder to reverse the trend of the junk status.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's easier said than done. And we look at case studies of countries around the world, Dr. Modise, and we have to question whether or not government as a whole, National Treasury leading the process, is undertaking the structural reforms required to appease the ratings agencies. They keep raising the same issues of weak economic growth, the risk of fiscal consolidation, economic inequality in the medium term, the rising contingent liabilities. This isn't as if the story for the ratings agencies is changing. Are we doing anything to directly address their concerns, or are we just hoping against hope every time they come for a rating that they'll give us another pass?
I think there's nothing wrong with hoping, but just when you look at what we have done as government, we have tried to implement these reforms. We were actually in a good track where before the cabinet reshuffle, where we managed to conclude the minimum wage, where cabinet endorsed and approved some of the reforms for state-owned companies, and we were looking at finalizing some of the legislation. I mean, we all know what the problems are for the country, and I think government's aim shouldn't to purely please the rating agencies, but we know what we have to do to turn the economy around. So the work has to happen. The rating agencies usually give you between 12 to 18 months before they change the rating and the outlook. So we just have a year to get our act together and make sure that the structural reforms that we propose are implemented and the results are more visible to the economy.
I mean, when does Moody's make its next pronouncement? Because Moody's, as we know, is the, if there is such a thing as a friendly ratings agency, they're the most friendly towards us. When is their next announcement on ratings? Do we have a date yet?
We don't have a date. You remember that they put us under review for downgrade, which takes about 3 months to conclude. So they came to the country between the 15th to the 23rd of May just to do an assessment. But they will certainly have something for us by end of June. So we're just waiting for them to complete the review for us.
Dr. Mamopo Modisa, thank you very much. The Chief Director of Strategy and Risk Management at the National Treasury. Listening to that is Ghulam Belim, the Chief Economist at Standard Bank, a man who's au fait with the vagaries of ratings agencies. I heaved a sigh of relief. Not that I expected anything different, but you never know with the ratings agencies, Ghulam. This is a piece of good news.
Bruce, hello. And indeed, this is welcome. One is mindful, though, and not to pepper the discussion thus far with some element of pessimism, but we remain on negative watch.
Yep.
And in that respect, given that it was on the 3rd of April, which is a very short time since then, that S&P downgraded South Africa, it was to be expected that they would not again necessarily downgrade South Africa, but would now seek for the minister to concretize some of his commitments with respect to consolidating the budget and showing a sense of policy continuity. So in that respect, October will be significant when the so-called or colloquially referred to mini-budget is released and the financial metrics and how it accords with the budget statement will be critical.
Yeah, I mean, and also we've got a finance minister with his back against the ropes already, based on his previous roles in government and the allegations out of the Gupta leaks that he is instrumental in various transactions that would not pass muster in many parts of the world while at home affairs and while at public enterprises. He denied that he'd done anything wrong today and he welcomed an inquiry. But this is a guy with other stuff on his mind, when really what we need is a finance minister who can focus on doing the job of being the finance minister and getting the country's finances in order without unwanted distractions.
So perfectly correct. And I think the swirl around the minister is unwelcome and it may be distracting. Thus far, he has continued in his commitment and steadfast in the policy dimensions that he's expressed over the last month and a bit. So in that respect, his resolve seems undimmed, but you are correct. In the coming days and weeks, we have already received indication that there is going to be more leaks that will provide and cast very bright light on historical evidence, and that may cast further aspersions and doubts on the integrity of the minister. And certainly, as you indicated, it would be unwelcome. However, I think in that respect, the rating agencies will still pause, other than, of course, Moody's, which will pronounce at the end of this month. And I wouldn't be surprised if they do lower South Africa's credit standing. Admittedly, and as you highlighted in your opening gambit, they have been favorable in their disposition to South Africa. So they still remain two notches above sub-investment grade. But for the moment, any hint of tilt with respect to the minister's actions at National Treasury that even in the most minor of manner undermines governance.
No, it most certainly does. I mean, the big warning in the S&P review, which came out at 5 to 6, I haven't had time to read it in any great detail, but the negative outlook on the foreign and local currency ratings reflects our view that political risks will remain elevated this year, which could undermine economic growth and fiscal outcomes more than we currently project. They say, we're giving you a chance to sort out your stuff. Do it, because we're coming and we have to downgrade later this year if you don't sort out your stuff. That's my subtext out of this.
So the most important data point that heralds a significant cue for our future, of course, is the ANC's elective conference in December. That outcome will be significant in terms of what it portends for our macroeconomic path in 2018 and beyond. Of course, the October statement will, the October mini budget statement will at least just give a sense of concretized continuity in terms of Finance Minister Gigaba's intent. But it will be in February of 2018, to the extent that the minister still prevails, and whatever ANC leadership emerges, the type of both rhetorical and policy biases that emerge built from the policy conference now in June and July and then cemented in December at the elective conference will be critical data pieces that the rating agencies will digest to judge whether South Africa needs to be either locked into its current mode, at least for a few years, or whether further rating downgrades are foreboding. But I think effectively it's an asymmetric situation right now. There is more likely the risk of further downgrades than there is a case of stabilization followed by imminent upgrades, at least with a two-year horizon.
Gulan Balin, thank you. The chief economist at Standard Bank, Afir, is absolutely right on that point. The National Treasury, with all the best will in the world, can't change the political decisions that have been foisted upon them. And so good work was being done. That good work, Melusi Gigaba has promised, will continue. And so far, so good in terms of sticking to that commitment. Absolutely pivotal is going to be the medium-term budget policy statement, October's mini-budget. Absolutely pivotal is going to be just how he can be seen to be in control of the country's finances and to keep spending under control and to find revenues from somewhere. I saw a piece out of RMB just recently saying that, you know, when Pravin Gordhan was finance minister in February, he was projecting economic growth of around 2% this year. Now, at very best, we're anticipating growth of 1% this year. That means growth is half of what we expected. And now, when you're a finance minister and you make a projection of a growth rate, that implies that you're going to get a certain amount of tax in. If the growth rate halves, well, the amount of tax you're going to collect is going to plummet as well. RMB's estimation, Rand Merchant Bank, is that we're going to see a shortfall of something between 40 and 50 billion rand. Now, that's going to come from one of two places. Either the South African government is going to go to the markets and borrow the money, and if we get the downgrades, that becomes more and more expensive. Well, they're going to come to you, and you, and you, yeah, all of you, and they're going to say, we need to have some more tax. And I know it was very neatly couched in the budget this year that the country's super rich, of people who earn, not super rich, people who earn more than 1.5 million rand a year are going to be paying 45% tax on the top end of their earnings. But the real people who coughed up in this budget were people who earned less than that. People who earned between, say, 500,000 and 1.5 million rand. They're the ones who are making up the lion's share of that tax collection. That's a lot of you. And if we don't get this economy right, if we don't dodge the ratings, those tax rates are at risk of going up again. That's, yep, you.
The Money Show.
The markets.
Just in case you missed it, the big story this evening is that S&P Global, which earlier on this year, 2 months ago, when the finance minister and his deputy were fired, and Moluzi Kigabo was appointed to the National Treasury. We saw S&P Global immediately downgrade our foreign debt to sub-investment grade and keep our locally denominated debt, 90% of our government debt, on a negative watch, but investment grade. So it's just like you've just got to sneeze and we go to junk, full-blown junk. All it's going to take is either Moody's or S&P to downgrade both our local and foreign currency debt for us to be sub-investment grade. And then all kinds of nasty things happen in the currency markets. Inflation starts going up and it starts getting very, very ugly. So far, so good, though, in terms of what's happening in the currency market. Andrew Bryson is a portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. I suppose what got the currency moving stronger today, Andrew, was that I wish we could be disappointing like America and have 138,000 jobs created, but they were anticipating 180,000 something, and therefore there was quite a big shortfall in American jobs.
Yeah, certainly, Bruce. I think what we have seen with the currency is the dollar has been soft, and potentially this jobs number just reinforced it. If we do see the rate hiking cycle slow in the States, we could expect more money coming into higher yield markets like ourselves.
And what's going to be interesting is next week's UK election, because Theresa May embarked on a snap poll to try and cement her position as a UK Prime Minister. And one wonders whether or not she misread the situation. Jeremy Corbyn doing a lot better than many had anticipated. Could we imagine if we saw a Liberal Democrat Labour coalition keeping the Conservatives out?
Yeah, I mean, what's been going on in the UK, it's certainly been a story that's playing out over a long period of time. And I think there's still a lot of uncertainty about how this Brexit's going to happen and, you know, who the leaders that are going to take it forward. So certainly that'll have an impact.
Yep, most certainly will. We watch the currency markets very closely. It's been positive for the Rand. I mean, the Rand is stronger against the euro, the pound and the dollar, and it's stronger today than it was in the last days of Pravin Gordhan's finance ministership. But that's because there's so much foreign money coming to South Africa by virtue of the fact that we are investment grade and the so-called passive funds are forced to invest in us. Give me a perspective on today's market. It seemed a little bit nowhere, really. I mean, we were up a couple of points, but pretty...
Yeah, a fairly lackluster day. Not too much to chat about really on the market today. I think what's interesting to see Barclays is up quite strongly, and I mean that's had a fantastic run since they had the big book build where Barclays sold its large stake of its shareholding.
What happened was Barclays PLC sold a big chunk of its shares in Barclays Africa. Can we call it APSA? Because that's really what
it might be APSA soon.
They must go back to calling it APSA just to avoid confusion.
Yeah.
And that's freed up a whole bunch of shares in the market, and that's brought some confidence into
it. It has, and I mean that. So I mean they issue those shares to local and overseas investors, with the PIC being the largest stakeholder there. And that was significantly oversubscribed. So there's clearly demand for those shares at that 132 Rand level that they were sold at. I think investors, looking at it as a good opportunity.
No, but we've seen the banking shares generally on the day being nice and positive. We saw Standard Bank also up, as was Liberty. Liberty's had a pretty good week. I mean, it's for all the wrong reasons, I suspect, and that is a very nice man, Thabo Tlotli, and the board at Liberty decided that they didn't want to work together anymore.
Yeah, look, I think Liberty has been one of those shares, or certainly in the insurance sector, that's underperformed. I think there's a lot of value there, but maybe investors looking for clarity with regards direction and strategy and a new man at the helm, you know, maybe that's giving investors heart.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what it looks like. David Munro, who's an investment banker, the third investment banker in 12 years, to go to Liberty to run it. Of course, there was first Miles Ruck and then Bruce Hemphill. Thabo Tlotli came in. He came in from Old Mutual via Stanlib to Liberty. And now you've got David Munro out of Standard Bank again. Wayne McCurry at Ashburton earlier this week was saying the only way Liberty is actually going to get back to profitability is to start slashing costs, because this isn't an economy in which an insurer is going to grow.
Yeah, and I think he's quite correct. I think, you know, all insurers are battling. I mean, you know, I mean, we could go through them, but none of them have had a fantastic year. I mean, you're dealing with a market that's pretty much going sideways in a very difficult economic climate. So, and unless they've got very strong offshore growth plans, I think locally it's going to be a tough market. And as you say, you know, Liberty's probably going to have to look at slashing costs and bringing in operating efficiency to get some of that value unlock.
Jack Amari, the chairman, was in the chair where you're sitting this evening, and he was just saying we need to grow faster into the African continent. I mean, they've scaled back the entire global business of Standard Bank to such an extent that they need to find new growth markets, and the Liberty expansion alongside Standard Bank hasn't been quite as aggressive as they would have liked.
Yeah, and I don't think, you know, Africa comes with this, with its own issues. You know, people have been operating there for a long time, and not everyone has been successful. So, you know, just to say that you're going to go into Africa and you're going to bring in the growth, I don't think it's you know, it's as easy as that.
I'm feeling unkind, so I'm going to ask you a mean question. Give me 1,000 rand, okay? Let's pretend there's 1,000 rand on the table. You have to put it into one thing.
Yes.
You either have to buy 1,000 rands worth of physical gold. You can hold it, and this is a 6-month view. You can either buy 1,000 rands worth of Bitcoin, or you can buy 1,000 rands worth of Naspers. Well, how unkind is that?
Look,
Tiki, so I think I'm a moment to think about it. I'm going to talk to my producer and saying, Tiki, so we need Friday night impossible question. I think so, because that's the impossible question.
Look, I mean, at the end of the day,
just one, it's fine.
Well, I mean, I would go for Naspers.
You would go for Naspers, yes. Ahead of Bitcoin and ahead of gold.
I would, and I mean, you know, if you look at Naspers and Bitcoin, the value there is perceived value, and it's what someone's willing to pay. Whereas Naspers, you know, you've got a company that's growing earnings, that's got a very successful track record. You know, the Tencent in China is doing phenomenally well, and we're seeing that company continue to grow earnings at a phenomenal pace. And then with regards to the local operations and the e-commerce and classified operations overseas, you're actually getting those for nothing.
Okay. I'll take Naspers. All right, there we go. 1,000 rand is Naspers versus Bitcoin. And, of course, physical gold. We can buy a little piece of a gold coin. My thanks to you very much for coming in this evening. Andrew Bryson, who's a portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. On a day where the all-share index went up 49 points, 52,889.
The Money Show.
Your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show, brought to you by the Old Mutual Investment Group. Invest where the fund managers invest. Two chief executives have left Donald Trump's Special Business Advisory Council after he announced last night that he was going to join Syria and Nicaragua as becoming the third country in the world to refuse to agree to the Paris Agreement on climate change. Now, both Robert Iger, the chief executive of Disney, and Elon Musk, the South African-born chief executive of Tesla, have announced they've quit this advisory board of Donald Trump's. Now, Syria's not a signatory because it's got bigger short-term crisis issues to deal with. The environment is the last thing on its mind, and that's understandable. Nicaragua has not signed because it doesn't believe that the climate change proposals go far enough. So it's saying, no, we're not signing this. It's not strong enough. You need to do more. But you can just imagine the Nicaraguans today. They're going to go, no, quickly, let's sign this thing because we don't want to be in the same camp as this lunatic Donald Trump who's refusing to sign the Paris, this Paris Agreement. It's a disaster. And if you've seen some of the German newspapers today and German magazines and swear words, like big, ugly, nasty swear words on the front of German magazines, basically saying Donald Trump has told the world to go away. I mean, it's quite scary. It really is quite scary. And Donald Trump soon may find himself classed along the same side as Syria. Well, coming up on your next Money Show, I'm talking to the author Tony Manning. He's a business strategist. He's written a brand new book. It's called The Critical Core, all about why strategy practices give companies an edge. Also, find out more about why Wayne McCurry, one of our regular market commentators, very popular market commentator Wayne McCurry, thinks about money the way he does on our Make Money Mondays feature.
The Money Show on
your number one news and talk station.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield, and The Money Show is brought to you by the Old Mutual Investment Group. Invest where the fund managers invest. It's time for the best bits of The Money Show. Let's get stuck into that. I spoke earlier this week about boardroom bust-ups, and of course, Thabo Dlotli, the chief executive of Liberty Company, announcing this week that he and the company have decided to part ways. I did get a message from him today. I approached him earlier this week for an interview, and he said he's going to take things easy, and his idea of taking things easy is to go and run the comrades tomorrow. So yeah, that's his idea of easy. He's off with many, many other people. I was in the airport earlier today and just seeing lots of very scrawny people wearing Interflora outfits. Because the Interflora logo and the comrades logo look very similar. I thought they were all working for Interflora. I said, geez, that must be Valentine's Day. Somebody's delivering flowers, but they weren't. They're all going off to the Comrades Marathon. But certainly, it was not a spectacular boardroom bust-up in the form of Ketso Gordon's stormy relationship with the PPC board and storming out and begging for his job back. Thabo Dorty is leaving Liberty. He's left it this week with immediate effect. Earlier this week, we had the Liberty chairman, the former chief executive of Standard Bank, Jacko Marie. He came into studio and he was explaining this very sudden parting of ways with Thabo Dorty. Dorty himself wasn't available to talk, but Marie says this is why he just had to go.
But the board generally just felt, a little bit uncomfortable about where we found ourselves at Liberty and how much more still had to be done and achieved and so on. And so after that, Sim Shabalala, who's the chief executive of Standard Bank and the major shareholder of Liberty, and I spent a lot of time with Thabo talking around, what had to be done, the priorities for the coming months, trying to figure out the speed of execution of different things, because when a company's going through toughish times, the list of things to do is 100 things, not 8 or 9, and so on, and through all that discussion, obviously a huge amount of pressure on the executive team and on the chief executive in situations like this, and through that process, Thabo came to the conclusion that really, if that was all the things that we had to get done and wanted done in that time order, and perhaps the best thing for us would be to think of going separate ways.
And that's what they've done this week. Well, something else that was big this week was this huge deluge of emails, the so-called Gupta mails, the leak gate, whatever you want to call it, between 100,000 and 200,000 emails coming out, and a number of names being mentioned time and time again, and lots of names being besmirched. Now today, Malusi Gigaba, the finance minister, was playing down the implications of these leaked emails and saying that he's not too concerned and he welcomes the various calls that have been made for a commission of inquiry into state capture. Well, the Gupta email leaks, many of you might be wondering whether or not they could ever be used as evidence in a court of law. I asked Bernard Hotz, the head of business crimes and investigations at Worksmans, precisely that on our Money Show FAQ feature. Frequently asked questions to you and me.
The standard procedure that should be followed in matters of this nature, and I would presume that the people who have these emails have done the following. We call it a chain of evidence, a chain of custody. And what generally happens is that when emails are handed over, one generally finds that somebody's hard drive has been handed over. You get forensic IT specialists in right from the beginning. They create a mirror image of the hard drive. They keep it sealed. It's a seal. It's a forensically sealed mirror drive, and they have a working copy. And then people work off the working copy. There's something called computer DNA metadata, which is crucial, because that will tell you if a document is authentic or not, who has amended it, who sent it to whom, and who's edited it, etc. So I would presume, and I was listening this morning on the news to Amar Bhagani saying precisely that. They have properly sealed these documents, they have followed the correct protocols, and everything that they're relying upon, they can back up through a metadata analysis.
Well, there's going to be lots of pushback, and it's going to get a little bit nasty, no doubt, as people try to clear their names around these leaks. And there are going to be so many good stories coming out of these emails, and watch this space. But the country is in a difficult place, and many people are getting quite morbid about it, and especially in the light of Donald Trump's decision in the last 24 hours to not sign the Paris Agreement and to take America out of that agreement on climate change. It's worrying a lot of people, including Jay Naidu. Now, Jay Naidu, former labor union organizer, he ran COSATU, he was a government minister in the Mandela government. He's also nowadays a social entrepreneur. He's a global thought leader. And he's written a brand new book called Change, Organizing Tomorrow Today. It was inspired by the fact that his daughter, who is must be in her 30s now, sat with him one day and said to him, "So, Dad, this future, you focus on politics, you focus on the past a lot, but what about the future?" So he spoke to Jay Naidu about his book.
I think that for me, having spent most of my life fighting for change and fighting to change the system, raising political consciousness and class consciousness, I think
I think 23 years later, I've had a rethink. I think that the most important thing we missed was to change the human being. No matter how perfect the system is, it will always corrupt the person that is in power or be corrupted by the person coming into power. I think this is what Mandela often talked about, you know, the RDP of the soul. I think it's a question about how do we put humanity and service and honesty and integrity, which are human values, back in politics, back in our economy, and back, most importantly, in our lives.
Jane Aidoo on The Money Show. We can't have going to the weekend without having a little bit of wine. Well, not literally rather than figuratively. Make Money Monday is a fabulous feature on a Monday night. If you've missed it, if you haven't listened to it, really is worthwhile. We get well-known South Africans, people who've done good, people who've excelled at various activities in their lives. And we always say to them, how good are you with money? And then they tell us their secrets, their small and yana skeletons come tumbling out. Well, it was the turn this week of Michael Fridgen, the wine expert. He's been in the news for other reasons this week, mostly to do with the Old Mutual Trophy Wine Show and the adjudication of some of South Africa's best wines. Well, before he did that, he came onto The Money Show and he gave us his insights into his first addiction and his first career.
If there was something I wanted and we couldn't have it, we were told we can't afford that. And that was simple enough. Also, I was made to realize that if I wanted something, I had to save up for it. Mm-hmm. On a penny or two pennies a week of pocket money, there wasn't much you could buy, even if you saved. And from a very early age, which is a bit of an on-air confession, I decided I wanted to smoke. And my mother was very tolerant. She said, you're welcome to smoke, but you have to pay for it yourself.
How old were you?
4 or 5. So it didn't work so well for me on tuppence a week, because Westminster 85 packs of 10 still cost about a shilling. And that was about 5 weeks of pocket money. And I didn't want to smoke quite that badly. So I then thought, which I suppose does address another question of what was the first money I ever earned. The first money I ever earned was to put on a clown suit that we had in the cupboard to make my way to the corner cafe, which was about 5 blocks from home, to put a hat on the street corner and to dance a jig for anyone coming past on the off chance that they would throw some money into the hat, and I could in that way earn enough money to buy a packet of cigarettes. My mother arrived and took me off the pavement. So my first career in earning money wasn't as exactly as successful as I wanted it to be.
Did you make anything before your mum found out?
I don't
Mrs.
think
Fridgen,
so.
Mrs. Fridgen, your son's on the pavement.
In an era of cell phones, the Bush Telegraph worked amazingly quickly.
It's a close community. Your son's embarrassing himself and you and all of us. Get rid of it.
And all I wanted was enough money. I mean, they said you have to pay for it yourself. And I was ready to be entrepreneurial and go out there and earn the money.
Did you ever achieve that self-destructive goal?
No, by the time I was 12, I'd given up smoking. It occurred to me that it wasn't really much fun. It was an expensive habit, and I was likely to get into much more trouble at school than I was at home. So it wasn't an addiction I wanted to acquire.
I mean, that was the fun bit of it. But he did talk very seriously about money, and he did also talk about other investments that he's got that adorn his home and fill his cellar that he believes have grown by far more than any financial investments that he's made. It was fascinating. And, I mean, you can listen to the whole of that interview and all the other interviews that we've done this week via our podcasts. Our podcasts are available free of charge on our website. Just go to the Money Show page and you will get instructions as to how you can download the podcast. Or you can subscribe to our podcast. You just go to wherever it is that you get your podcasts from and you can get them for nothing. Please, I suggest you do, because we have so much great information, which if you do miss it, you miss out.
The Money Show.
The Biz Quiz.
2,000 rand up for grabs this evening on 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. If you want to play the Brutal Biz Quiz this evening, give us a shout, because I've got 2,000 rand to give away. Which country is the world's largest producer of avocados? There is one country in the world that produces 8 times more avocados than anyone else. Which one is it? Give us a call now. 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567.
It's time to put your business knowledge to the test. The Biz Quiz with MTN on The Money Show.
Right, let's get ourselves a whiz of the Brutal Biz Quiz this evening. Which country is the biggest producer of avocados? Oliver in Swane?
Mexico.
Mexico is most certainly the biggest producer of avocados. It dominates the world of avocados. We spoke to Kevin Lings this week, whose wife loves avocados, so he had to go and do the research. Who owns Wimpy, Tasha's, and Whackaberry?
Come again?
Who owns Wimpy, Tasha's, and Whackaberry?
Oh.
Three. Two. Oliver.
Famous brand.
Oh, Oliver, there. No, it's right, Gemotso. It's right. Don't give Oliver a heart attack. Gemotso. Jeez, Oliver, nearly died. We're going to be quicker with you, Oliver. We're going to be quicker with you. Yes, famous brands, absolutely. Darren Hill this week and why they skipped the dividend for the first time in 13 years. Who was the Minister of Post, Telecommunications and Broadcasting between 1996 and 1999?
Is it Jane Addo?
Jeez, Oliver, you're speeding up. That's good. Oliver, you're doing well. We spoke about him in his book, Change, Organizing Tomorrow Today, in our business book feature. Thabo Dlotli is changing jobs, but he started out where? Where was Thabo Dlotli's first job?
I'm
afraid not, Oliver. Thanks for playing. Paul in Somerset West, where was Thabo Dlotli's first job at insurance?
I think it's Liberty.
No, Paul, I'm afraid not. Samir in Florida.
Hello.
Samir in Florida, where was Thabo Dlotli's first job in insurance?
Old Mutual.
Pardon?
Old Mutual.
Correct. Did you know that, or did you just go, I need to knock off another insurance company? No, he was at Old Mutual. He was at Old Mutual, Samir. You're only Old Once, published in 1986, is an adult book by which famous children's author? You're only Old Once, written by a children's author, in 3, 2, and 1.
Dr.
Samir.
Seuss?
Oh, Samir, you came close. Because, of course, you know that I mentioned Dr. Seuss earlier this week. He only wrote 2 adult books, did Dr. Seuss, the other being The Seven Lady Godivas, The True Facts Concerning Family, History's Barest Family, and it had nude drawings in it in 1939. It was an absolute flop. But what emerged this week is that staff at the Bank of England studied his writing style as part of a push to make communications more clearly understood by the general public. The central bank analysed Dr. Seuss after finding that just 1 in 5 people could read and understand its inflation report. I never understood Dr. Seuss to start off with. I don't know why they chose him, but that's just me. Okay, Samir, your next one. What is the popular term used to describe a severance package? If somebody leaves a company or they become unemployed and it's all on good terms, they are given a what? Is it a bronze kick in the pants?
Golden handshake.
Ah, Samir, there we go. In media, you get a bronze kick in the pants. You never get a golden handshake, I tell you that much. Now, Alan Gray, the shareholder at NetOne, is absolutely furious that the former chief executive of NetOne UEPS got a massive 105 million rand payoff. Which high-profile South African-born business leader resigned from Donald Trump's advisory council today after the US said it was withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement?
Oh, it's a guy from Tesla, Elon Musk.
You don't need to shout somewhere. I know you're excited. I know you're feeling like you've got this in the bag. I know you think that you are a deserving whiz of the Brutal Biz Quiz. It's absolutely Elon Musk, the Tesla and SpaceX chief executive, tweeting very shortly after the announcement, "I'm departing presidential councils. Climate change is real. Leaving Paris is not good for America or the world." Who said yesterday, "I was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris"? The answer would be the guy who Elon Musk just left, and his name is Donald Trump. Absolutely right, Samir. Well done to you. You're the whiz of the Brutal Biz Quiz this evening. Samir has eaten the competitors like a mealy. 5 in a row. What a good run Samir had this evening. Well done to you, Samir. You get 2,000 Rand courtesy of MTN Business. I wish you would have given more people a chance to play, but you didn't because you're selfish, which is fine because now you've got 2,000 Rand.